We may not be done with COVID for some time, but the mass vaccination campaign is gaining traction in ways that make it possible to imagine different times ahead, when we're not advised to mask up for a trip to the store, when we'll feel comfortable enough in close proximity to strangers to return to restaurants and theaters and airplanes, and when work from home is an occasional perk, not an emergency mandate. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. As we prepare to return to what we once took for granted, all eyes are on the economy. What needs to happen with interest rates to encourage investment without creating bubbles or jacking inflation? And when will the worst affected workers, broadly those at the lowest end of the income spectrum, begin to get back on their feet? The Federal Reserve will have a major role to play in guiding the fiscal recovery. So we've invited Dallas Fed President and CEO Robert Kaplan back to talk about what's likely to happen in the next few months. Rob, welcome back to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Good to talk to you.
Do you see the light at the end of the tunnel of the effects of COVID-19 on this economy?
Yes. I think we're starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel. We're not there yet. We're still in a vaccination race against growth and the variants, and that race is not over yet. And so we still need to aggressively vaccinate the population, try to outrun these variants, and in the meantime, practice, I think, mask wearing and social distancing. But we're getting to the point where there's a prospect that we can win this race.
You and I have talked several times over the past year, and it strikes me every time that you're paying such close attention to public health guidelines. Did you ever imagine when you accepted this position at the Fed that you would have to be paying attention to something like viral variants and the importance of testing and tracing of this infection?
No, I didn't imagine it. But what I've learned in this job is you have to take the world and the economy as it is and as it unfolds. And that means in this seat, you've got to be open to learning regularly and constantly. And this is one example of that. I have to go to where the world is going and try to understand it.
What is your sense of the things that are still likely to be different even after we've reached something close to herd immunity? How will the way the economy works broadly be different post-COVID-19?
So I guess I'll talk broadly, and then I'll talk with some of the challenges businesses are facing. But broadly, digitization, that term, has been with us for years, and most businesses wanted to have more online or digital presence, and it was a nice thing to have. Now, for most businesses, it's not just a nice thing. For many, it's a mandatory thing. And what do I mean by that? If you run a fast food restaurant chain, you better have a technology investment in pre-ordering and pickup. And so I think the pandemic has accelerated that. We knew for years that the U.S. economy was likely overstored. I mean, we have more retail per capita than most any other country in the world. So we thought over the years, there'll be fewer malls, they'll have to be repurposed, and so on and so forth. The pandemic has accelerated that. And so we'll get to where we would have gotten, but we're going to get there faster, and you'll see more quickly malls are going to have to be repurposed, and there'll be less retail per capita. There's going to be people are going to make different decisions about business travel. Most of us, you know, we'll say I could do that meeting remotely rather than taking a business trip and spending the night in a hotel, but there'll be a big pent-up leisure travel that may help offset that. I can go through lots of examples, but those are a few. And most businesses, depending on what industry they're in, are trying to wrestle with that and try to figure out what the future is going to look like.
Retail has been a giant source of jobs in this country, if not necessarily well-paying jobs, for some time now. Do those jobs simply go away as businesses move to more digital, less brick and mortar, or can they be somehow converted so that people who used to be standing behind a counter will now sit behind a computer and fulfill orders?
Some of the jobs will come back and are coming back, and some, yes, will go away. And And it means that workers who worked in those jobs, particularly in person-to-person contact service industries, may have to find either other businesses to go work at or other industries. And so what's an example of what might offset that? We've noticed there's a meaningful growth in package delivery, warehousing, logistics, not surprising because of more online purchasing. And we've seen already a trend, and we hear in talking to businesses already a trend in people migrating to those industries. So it won't be black and white. There'll be plenty of retail jobs. There'll be plenty of restaurant jobs. There'll be plenty of jobs in person-to-person contact industries. My guess is not as many, but there's going to be a lot of growth in other jobs that we probably hadn't anticipated.
What kind of specific ongoing support will the economy need from the Fed over the next few quarters?
So, as we go through this period, I mean, my own view is while we're in the teeth of the pandemic, which we still are, there's light at the end of the tunnel, or another way to say it, we're turning the corner, but I'd like to see the corner. And until we see that, until I see it, I think the Fed should be aggressive in terms of its asset purchases and the Fed funds rate. As we begin to turn the corner, the first thing I'll be looking for throughout 2021 is will there be greater evidence we've weathered the pandemic and that we're making substantial further progress towards full employment and our price stability goals? And when we do that, and when I see that, and that'll be a judgment call, I'll be an advocate for beginning the process of weaning off some of these extraordinary measures, starting with our asset purchases. I just don't know when that will happen, and I'll explicitly avoid predicting the calendar, time in the calendar when that might happen.
You're talking about asset purchases. As I understand it, the Fed is still buying up large amounts of bonds each month. Is that what you're talking about there?
Yeah, we're buying $80 billion of treasuries and $40 billion of mortgage-backed securities. And the first step, ultimately, in removing some of this extraordinary accommodation, it will begin with addressing those asset purchases. That'll be the first benchmark that I'll be trying to judge as time goes on.
What has been the goal of that bond buying?
Well, initially, when we started it back in March, April of 2020, it was to stabilize financial markets. Which were seizing up, and to ensure that we had good access to capital, at least from the public markets. And that, along with PPP and other programs, were intended to help businesses be able to finance themselves. And yes, in addition, it was also intended to create some support for the economy. As we've headed now through 2020 and into 21, there's less need, in my opinion, in terms of market function, but it still does provide support to the economy. And what's an example? Mortgage rates are very low, and that's helped spur the housing business, for example. But there'll be a point at which I think we'll be much healthier to wean off those purchases.
Yeah, obviously, low interest rates are good for people and for businesses looking to borrow money. Is there a danger that keeping money so cheap will cause borrowers to make financially risky decisions or will inflate bubbles in certain sectors of the economy?
Yeah, so one of the side effects, which we have to acknowledge, and I think it's wise to publicly acknowledge, is when you keep the Fed funds rate at zero, it means saving in a typical account or money market fund isn't terribly attractive. You don't earn on it. And yes, it does have the effect for individuals and investors and institutions of pushing them to take more risk. And the thing we have to be cognizant of, and I am, in the middle of a crisis, that may be appropriate, but at the point where we are emerging from the crisis and we're making progress in the economy, I think it's a much healthier to begin when we can to wean off that, so that because until we do, It has the effect of encouraging market participants to take more risk and maybe more risk than they should. And that creates its own set of risks down the road.
Congress has had a role to play in all this as well. What do you see as the most important effects of the stimulus checks that most American adults have received?
Well, first, one of the unusual things about this pandemic, which is worth pointing out, normally when you have a severe downturn like we did in the second quarter of 2020, you'd see a big fall off in household income and consumer spending. We did not see that this time. And the main reason we didn't was fiscal support. People who lost their jobs or couldn't get enough hours had fiscal support that they were able to use to make ends meet and continue spending. So household spending for all of 2020 remained very strong and very solid. It is still having that effect today, but we still have millions of people who are either out of work or are underutilized in terms of working. So this unemployment benefits helps people make ends meet. In addition, I've talked about the fact that it's critical that we have enough money to speed vaccinations, that we have enough money to reopen schools in person. I think the money that could go to making greater access to affordable childcare is very important because we talk about low-income workers having suffered disproportionately. We also see that working mothers have disproportionately left the workforce since the pandemic started. So some of those fiscal measures, I think, will make it easier and more likely that working mothers will re-enter the workforce. And all those things are very important to limit scarring and improve the recovery.
I think you've said that if we don't get women back to work, we won't have a recovery.
Well, I think it's a key piece of recovery. So by our best estimate at the Dallas Fed, the prime age participation rate for women with children has gone down something like 5.5 percentage points. That is a dramatic decline. We didn't see anything like that in the Great Recession. And GDP growth is made up of growth in the workforce and growth in productivity. And so it's critical that we get women who've left the workforce, get them back into the workforce. But in order to do that, their kids need to be in school and they need to have access to childcare.
Any concern that all that stimulus money might begin to drive inflation higher than we want it?
So there's no question that the amount of fiscal stimulus has been much larger than the stimulus we had in the Great Recession. And it's a big reason why at the Dallas Fed, we're forecasting approximately 6.5% GDP growth for 2021. If without the sizable fiscal stimulus, our estimate would be lower. And so we're going to have no question, a surge in demand as we reopen, and also as money from the stimulus is spent. And there's also no question that we've got supply-demand imbalances already in metals, wood products, building products, and so on. And so we think there'll be a surge in prices. There already is in a number of items in 2021. And my best guess is that'll begin to moderate in 2022, but we'll be watching that very, very carefully.
Rob, has the Fed changed its framework for targeting inflation?
We in the fall announced a new framework which did the following. Historically, when the Federal Reserve saw a tightening in the labor market, at some point in that improvement in the unemployment rate, tightening the labor market, we would begin to anticipate inflation and begin to raise rates. The experience over the last 5 or 10 years was that inflation has been very muted, probably surprisingly muted. I think one of the big reasons for that is technology and technology-enabled disruption, i.e., increased digitization. And innovative platforms have limited the pricing power of business. That and globalization have probably muted some of the cyclical pressures you normally get in a tight labor market. And I think we spent a year on a listening tour, revisiting our framework. And what we decided is, in the future, we're going to be less likely, and we're not going to preempt and anticipate inflation, and we're going to be willing to let inflation run moderately above 2% for some time in service of trying to create a more inclusive and more robust labor market. And so I'd say that's the most significant part of the change. And it requires a little bit of adjustment for the public. We're still anchored, and we want to anchor inflation expectations at 2%, and we want to average 2%, but we're willing to run moderately above for some time in order to get to that average.
Why is 2% the ideal, or a little above that? Why not 1% or 3% or whatever?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of historical debate about that, and I think the thought is, I think 1%'s too low, in that if you're that low, you might risk deflation. 3% is probably too high. And so several years ago, and before my time at the Fed, I think the committee settled on a target of 2%. We'll continue to revisit that, but I believe still 2% is a pretty good target.
We talked broadly about U.S. employment. How are the employment numbers in Texas?
I'd say similar to the whole United States, meaning the pattern of the downturn and the recovery. I think Texas has pretty much mirrored that. The one big difference between Texas, though, and the rest of the country is pre-pandemic, we had a trend of migration of people and firms to the state from the rest of the country. I think since the start of the pandemic, that trend has accelerated, and many more businesses and firms and people are moving here. And so we've got stronger labor force and population growth than the rest of the country. And I'd actually expect that to continue for some time.
Is there something about the way we do business in Texas that makes it especially attractive to businesses wanting to relocate?
Well, yes, so there's a number of reasons. And when I talk to people moving here or thinking about it, low taxes, central location, climate for some, pro-business attitude, very welcoming environment. And I would also say it's a little bit of a virtuous cycle. The more people who move here, the more people thinking about locating here. And I would put on the list availability of a talent pool, and I think a big improvement in skills training, and also a beefing up of many of our colleges and universities through the state. And those are very critical to attracting businesses here.
Education has been something you've really emphasized for a long time. How concerned are you about potentially a year or a year and a half of learning loss among students who have only been able to do school online?
So I'm concerned about it. As we've talked before, the pandemic has disproportionately affected low-income workers, those with a high school education and less, because they're more likely to work in person-to-person industries. And what we're finding is it's disproportionately likely affected their children, in that they may less likely have access to Wi-Fi. They've had to be, this is true of all kids, they've had to be remote. And this is true of all children, not just low-income children. But the risk is that these kids are falling behind and they'll lose a year. And one of the big worries you've heard me talk about before is early childhood literacy among the fastest growing demographic groups, Blacks and Hispanics, is lagging in the state of Texas. And you worry that if early grade school kids are losing a year of schooling, they may fall even further behind. And that's the workforce of the future in the state. That's our future labor force.
We've learned that many kinds of people can successfully work from their homes. Of course, it depends on the job, or they can work somewhere other than a company-furnished office. What will work from home look like? Will it last long after the end of the pandemic?
Yeah, so this is one of the things, and I'm talking to businesses widely, and we're going through this analysis also at the Fed. There's things we know and there's things we don't know yet. So we know that in the past, we used to think, we can be flexible, but there are limits to how flexible we can be to accommodate some of our workers. And I think we've learned from the pandemic, we can be more flexible and effective than we thought. We can be flexible without trading off effectiveness. The part I don't know is we also hear reports of greater mental stress, depression from workers that are working in an isolated area at home, alone, responding to email, texts, on Zoom calls. And I think we're finding that we can tolerate working remotely because we didn't have a choice this last year. But I think for the health and well-being and morale and building the culture, and also if you're in a business that competes, building relationships, you know, there's a real benefit to having people in person. And so every business and all of us by unit are going to have to just weigh the importance of that. But I think the surprise may be that there's more back in-person work than people might have predicted because the impact it has on a person's health, well-being, morale, the culture of their unit, the competitiveness of their company. I think we may be more in person than we might have thought.
Seems like there might be big questions that businesses have to answer about how much they're spending renting or owning the real estate where their employees work, where they show up to the office every day, if they're going to show up to the office twice a week or something.
There's no question. And I'm having those conversations regularly. And the best way I can describe it is businesses right now are wrestling with these issues. And the reason they're not coming to a conclusion is I think they've been surprised by what they learned over the last 12 months. And I think they're cognizant of the fact they may be surprised over on what they learn over the next 12 months. So, I mean, my own advice to business leaders I talk to, be flexible, try to figure out what you want to do. How do you want to do the transition of back to work? But be prepared. You may learn some things in the next 6 to 12 months that surprise you. And leave flexibility to the fact that I would be careful about drawing hard and fast conclusions that are hard to undo, because I think we may be in for some surprises from here.
What have been the most significant changes to the oil and energy sectors over the past year?
So it starts with, we had not only a demand shock last March, that started last March because of COVID and global demand fell off, but we had a supply shock too, where OPEC plus Russia had their dispute, and they actually increased production at a time where global demand was collapsing. So what was the upshot of all that? We had a plunge in the price of oil, we had a glut of inventory, and we've been working off that excess inventory ever since, and we haven't worked it off yet. Having said that, from what we can tell, global demand is not back to normal, but it's moving toward, moving toward the level it was in February of 2020. And we'll get there probably not by the end of this year, but maybe in the first quarter of 2022. And we think that excess inventory is going to get worked off as early as by the end of 2021. So we're going to be in better balance. Now, the things we also don't know is what decisions OPEC will make on supply. We don't know what will happen with the Iran oil deal, or the Iran strategic deal, and what impact that has on oil. So there's still some question marks in terms of supply demand, but we're moving toward working off this excess inventory. The issue for the industry, though, is it's very hard if you're in a fossil fuel business right now to attract capital. If you're going to drill, it's going to have to be out of cash flow. And most of the participants in this industry have promised their shareholders that they're going to return a much higher percentage of cash flow going forward than they have in the past. So there won't be as much capital for drilling. And so we don't think we ended 2020 with production at about 11 million barrels a day. We think we'll be up a little bit this year, maybe 11, 11 and a half million barrels a day, but not as much as people might think, because one, the decline curve, you have to drill a lot to replace the decline because of shale. And in addition, the industry has got to fund its CapEx out of cash flow, and it's promised shareholders it's going to return more cash flow to them. So we've got to monitor what impact this all has on global supply and demand.
How do state and local budgets look around Texas after this very strange year?
Well, you know, I would have said earlier in 2020, I was very concerned what I was hearing from state officials and local officials, that they were going to have to make layoffs to make ends meet, to balance their budgets. And they're going to have to make cutbacks. I think because the economy has improved somewhat faster than people expected, I think their current rate of revenues, by and large, is much better than they would have anticipated 6 months ago. But I can tell you, there are cities and towns, not just here, but across the country. And I heard this working on the municipal facility for the Fed. There's still some cities and towns that have not recovered yet from that fiscal hole from the second quarter of last year, but current run rates have improved dramatically.
What has, broadly speaking, what has productivity looked like over this past year? Has it matched what your expectations were given the strange circumstances of the pandemic?
Well, what we found is people can be more productive than we thought working remotely. We've also, though, seen a mixed change in the labor force, meaning, as I mentioned, low-income workers and those in person-to-person contact industries have disproportionately lost their jobs. And I think those jobs tend to, not always, but tend to be lower productivity jobs, if you look at just classic GDP per worker hour. So I think it's hard to make judgments about productivity because of the strange situation we're in right now, where certain segments of our economy just aren't back to normal. But I think that's the big question. Our concern and my concern through the pre-pandemic was that productivity improvements had more directly been experienced by those with a college education or greater. And those with a high school education or less that tend to be in service sector jobs were more likely seeing technology-enabled disruption cause their job to be restructured or eliminated, and they weren't experiencing the productivity. I'm hopeful coming out of this pandemic, maybe we'll see something different, but I think, again, back making a sizable investment in our communities and skills training, I think is probably the number one thing we can do to help improve that statistic.
When the Fed gets to the point that it begins to wean the economy off the kinds of extraordinary supports that it's provided for the past year, are there shocks that we should brace ourselves for? What will be the downside of taking away some of that support?
So I joined the Fed in 2015, and our first rate increase was in December of 2015. This is post-Great Recession. And what I learned from that experience, and also the actions we took at the time to start reducing the size of our balance sheet, communication is critical. Giving market participants and citizens in the economy advance warning as to what we're thinking. This requires an adjustment. And I think it has to be done slowly. It has to be done carefully. And I think we learned a lot from coming out of the Great Recession, but I think the aftermath of the pandemic is going to be different. So we're going to have to adapt some of those lessons. But I've said this many times, there's no textbook for how you wean the economy off some of these extraordinary measures. And I think you have to, I think as hard as dealing with the pandemic was, I think the next couple of years will be just as challenging because it's hard to withdraw these extraordinary accommodations.
Robert Kaplan is president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. Rob, it's always nice to speak with you. Thank you for making time.
Thank you, Chris. Great to talk with you.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Ana Perez, Nilufer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Madison Hurd, Sriya Reddy, and Rolando Hernandez. You can listen to Think wherever you get your podcasts. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.